Very nice.
Committee. Thank you.
Howdy. My name's Otto, and I'm an alcoholic. I thought it was going to be delightful to get away from the Texas heat. Come up here in the mountains where it's nice and cool, but it is warm in here tonight, so excuse me for taking off my jacket. But I hope to finish. Thank you all so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here. I want to thank Phyllis for making that drive down to Bangor and getting me. I was told I was flying into Bangor, but I was afraid we were going to end up at different airports, but she was there. And we were looking for sheep coming back. I saw some of those little wooden sheep you stick in the yard we were doing U-turns all over going back trying to find some of those little sheep. If I could send one of those home to my wife, she'd feel better. My son in high school, we had some of those. My son used to refuse to bring his friends over because we had sheep in our yard. So if anybody knows where there's some at, see me after the meeting. We had a good time. Not only was she an excellent driver and a hostess, but she was also a pretty good tour guide. We did take the scenic route, which took a little longer than the express. And she was telling me a few things about your wonderful state while coming up, and I learned a little bit. I didn't know a lot about Maine. I've never been to Maine before. Matter of fact, there's a lot of places I ain't never been before, but all I knew about Maine was that the University of Maine are the Black Bears. Is that right? And I know you have pretty good baseball teams at the University of Maine, because I'm an Oklahoma State University fan, and we have pretty good baseball teams. And we've squared off a few times. Anyway, coming up, she was telling me about, you know, that I'd probably run across a mosquito or two while I was here. And that if I got lucky, we might run across a moose. I've never seen a real moose. I'd like to see a moose. And I asked her, I said, is there any chance we might see a black bear? She said, they're around, but there's not a good chance that we'll see a black bear. And I said, well, if we was to come upon a black bear, what should we do? Because I don't know about you guys, but I'm from the big city, and this here's the woods, okay? And she says, well, if we come across a black bear, turn around and run. Now, I thought, there's no way we can outrun a black bear. And she says, that's true. But I figure I can outrun you. She's a wonderful host. Is this your water? That's the way I like to drink anyway. Matter of fact, when they invented these, isn't that the cutest thing you ever saw? I'm a drinker. I'll drink a lot while I'm up here talking, but it's water for those of y'all listening to tape. But that's why I've got this wireless mic on. I might have to go pay before I get done. So if y'all find me in the restroom while the talk's still going on, just remember, it's all live, folks. Watch what you're saying there. If there's anybody standing up there, I see there's a few empty chairs. If you've got an empty chair beside you, why don't you raise your hand so the folks stand. If you'd like to come sit down, it's cooler up here than it is back there because it's not so crowded. Anybody like to come take a seat? Hold your hand up. Anybody? Okay. I know. Somebody told y'all about me. Everybody stays near the exits with me. This guy will wear you out. Yeah. Paul O. said one time when I was at one of his meetings, he says, if y'all get done before I do, just feel free to excuse yourself. And I am starting my 1 hour timer now. Okay? And I don't expect to be done in an hour, okay? So, some of you have been sitting for a long time. If it gets warm, just go ahead and stand up, everybody. Come on. Just give your old rear end a good old scratch, because I'm fixing to wear you on you. We just do what we got to do. Anyway, got a note here to myself. Don't suck on your teeth. Don't say and don't say you know. Okay. I've been to Toastmasters. I'm really not from Texas. I'm from Oklahoma, which is an annex of Texas. I moved to Texas about 12 years ago. Didn't think it was going to be that different. Silly me. Anyway, I'm adjusted now, and I do consider myself a Texan, even though I will not lay any claim to George Bush. You wouldn't consider that a political statement. Where's our delegate? That's not a political statement. Anyway, I am from Oklahoma. I grew up in a family of six. I'm the oldest boy, second child. I have an older sister, two younger brothers. And my mom and dad liked to drink. So I never saw drinking as queer or abnormal. It's been going on around me my whole life. Drunkenness, squawking and fighting and carrying on and being stupid come natural to me. When that starts happening, I don't think there's anything odd going on. If I wanted to see my dad when I was a boy, I'd go down to the tavern if I wanted to hang out with him. I grew up drinking them onion fried cheeseburgers at Hank's Villa Tap Room, playing shuffleboard and a horse collar and dominoes, shooting a little pool, waiting for the bookie to come in, and never saw anything queer about getting drunk or getting in a fight. I grew up living on eggshells because my daddy had some rules that he tried to enforce in our home. I thought they were the rules. I didn't know they were just his rules, but these were the rules that I grew up with. Things like big boys don't cry. You want to cry? I'll give you something to cry about. Don't be afraid. Don't feel bad. If you feel bad or if you're scared, there's something wrong with you. So I ain't. You can do anything you put your mind to. Practice makes perfect, and where there's a will, there's a way. If anyone can, you can. You always give a man a good hand. It's just like Penn and Teller, isn't it? Yeah, I kept Rolaids in business a long time trying to live by some of my daddy's rules. And he's my first higher power, my dad. And he had a lot of power. My father was a police officer with the Oklahoma City Police Department. I mean, he could raise his hand, blow a whistle, and the whole city would stop. And if you didn't stop and do what my daddy told you to, he could get on a radio and get enough folks that they'd make it so you did what he wanted you to do. He put me in jail when I was 8. He just took me right on downtown, just locked me up. Says, I just want you to know. I'll be good, Daddy. I'll be good. I grew up in a violent home, a chaotic home. My mom and dad married and divorced each other 3 times before I got out of high school. They couldn't live without each other. They couldn't live with each other. I can remember laying in bed at night as a young boy just terrified that they were going to come home because the fight was going to start. And I've never been able to sleep. Matter of fact, I always thought I had a sleep disorder. That's kind of my problem. I don't have a drinking problem. Matter of fact, kind of like court drinking's been my solution for a long time. I need to get to sleep. I can't get to sleep. I have a few drinks to knock the edge off and help me get tired. I need to get up and go to work in the morning. I ain't been in a couple days. Damn, I just can't get to sleep. And I really, that made sense to me. I never saw myself as a person who had a drinking problem. I had no idea what an alcoholic was before I met you. That's the truth. I thought an alcoholic was kind of a W.C. Fields kind of guy, like I'd seen on TV, or a Mel Brooks, what's that fellow, Foster Brooks, you know? That must be what an alcoholic works like. Certainly not a police, fine, outstanding police officer like my father. You know, my mom's a postal clerk. She works hard. And so I had no idea when drinking became a problem for me that it was a problem. That was just my normal. But I could always rationalize, justify, minimize, explain away my drinking so that the drinking was never the problem. You know, that because our world has to make sense. The world I live in has to make sense. You know, 2 and 2 is 4. That's up. That's down. And whatever else is going on needs to make sense. So I would figure out a way to make that happen. And some people would call that denial. Our big book calls it delusion. I'm one who never tried to quit drinking. I know there's many amongst us tonight, and my heart goes out to you, who've tried to quit drinking and failed and tried again and tried again and tried again. And all I can say to you is don't quit trying. Come on back. You know, and if you get one hand in mine and one hand in Dave's, you won't have a hand to drink with, okay? And we'll just hang out till you quit drinking. But anyway, so I never saw drinking as a problem. I got a lot of problems, but drinking ain't one of them. I'm this kind of guy who's never been able to catch a break. I don't know about you guys, but I have just never had a long run of good luck. I was born on Christmas Day. Hey, if you ain't been there, you don't know. But I've been screwed since day one, okay? Where's my harmonica player? I need a little "Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen," if you would believe it. He'll be back. I grew up in stark raving terror. I remember hearing my mother scream, opening the bedroom door, that converted garage, and looking down those stairs, seeing my father on my mother's chest with his knees pinning her shoulders to the bed, his fists hit her in the face, blood all over the bed and all over the walls, and her screaming, and him pointing at me and telling me to get back to my room. And we went. We get up the next day and we act like nothing happened. And we go to school. And when I went to school, I dated Laura. Lori. All right. Sorry, Court. I was not on the bowling team, buddy. I'm class president, top teen. I'm head of student council. I emcee the pep rallies. I head up the paper drives. I'm voted the friendliest boy in my school. I'm class president. I'm a stud jock athlete. I'm pretty much got it going on, and I do date the cheerleader, okay? And that was my way of making people think everything was okay, because you see, what's going on at home, that's family business. And if you grew up in a home like mine, or if you raised your kids in a home like the one I grew up in, well, see, that family business we know stays at home. And what we present to the outside world has nothing to do with what's going on at home. I was always scared to death that if you knew what was really going on in my house, you wouldn't want anything to do with me. And that's why I'm the friendliest boy in my school. And I swore, like many of us, that I would never be like my father. But as I said, I never tried to quit drinking because I didn't know I had to. So inevitably, you know, because I've got that gene that says I'm predisposed, when I drank, I was just on my way to being just like my dad, no matter how hard I tried not to be. It just manifests different. You know, I never hit my wife and I never hit my kids, so therefore I'm different. I'm not like my daddy. Now the fact that I beat the hell out of my dogs, you know, that don't count. But that's a good story. I'll tell you that one in a minute. Yeah. Anyway, I couldn't wait to get out of the house. I went off to Oklahoma State University. I'm the first member of my family on either side to graduate from high school. Much less go to college. Unfortunately, when I got to college, there were no reins on my drinking. And I like to drink. And I need to get up and go to class tomorrow. I haven't been in a few days. But I made the mistake of joining a fraternity. I'm a Sig Alpha, Oklahoma State. Well, no, I'm not. I never got initiated. You see, I got in trouble. The membership came to me and they said, Otto, when you drink, you embarrass us. You got to go something now to embarrass the fraternity boys. But I don't know. This is back in the 60s, and streaking was real popular. And I just loved to lose my shorts. I just loved it. You know, inappropriate places and times, though. Mom's Day is not a good time to streak, you know. Anyway, they said, you can't drink anymore till you become a member of this here fraternity. You are what we're going to call a dry pledge. That's the end of that fraternity. Needless to say, I never got initiated. You know, the darndest thing is, I always thought I chose to drink. I thought I chose to drink every time I drank. I just figured I just never chose not to. I never had a clue that I was drinking because I had to. Never had a clue. Anyway, I didn't do very good in school because I was drinking. And matter of fact, it's real ironic. There was a tavern there called the Draft Board. And I like to go in there and drink that draft beer. And because I did that, instead of going to class, I got drafted. So in 1967, I went off into the military. Now, I just knew, being the stud that I was, that they were going to make me a general's aide. Or they would, you know, put me in charge of the NCO club. It'd be a happening joint now, let me tell you, okay? It'd be one of the best NCO clubs in the USA Army. Well, they put me in the motor pool. I like cars. I'm a racing nut. I love cars. The little house I grew up in is located right outside of turn two of the speedway. You know, when the cars come around the second turn, them old jalopies, they throw mud in my front yard. We grew up in a fine neck of the woods. But anyway, they didn't do that. They said, they tested me and said, Otto, you look like pretty good material for the infantry. I couldn't believe that. You know, I've just never been able to catch a break. And, you know, 67, 68, Vietnam's going on, and I didn't want to go to war as an infantryman. And so I did everything I could do to avoid going to war. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but my best thinking sucks. And my best plans don't work, never have, but, you know, I figure if I try hard enough and where there's a will, there's a way. And if anyone can, you can. I can get it. Well, I'm trying to make it happen. I've been dancing pretty much as fast as I can my whole life. It just don't work. And so anyway, I avoided going over there as long as I could. I made rank of E5 before I went to Vietnam. So I went as a squad leader, which I thought was a much better plan than going as the little guy in the squad. I'd much rather be the leader than the follower. I don't know about you guys. I like being in charge. I'm kind of a take charge kind of guy. And but, you know, my best thinking, see, they give me a squad of 9 men, and I take 3 men, go out for 3 days, 2 nights, come back to the fire base, spend the night. And then I get 3 others, and I go out for 3 days, 2 nights, come back, spend the night at the fire base. And I get 3 guys, I go out for 3 days, 2 nights, come back, spend the night at the fire base. Then we all 9 go out together, 3 days and 2 nights, come back, spend the night at the fire base. Then we go out on a platoon size suite, 3 nights, 2 days, come back to the fire base. Time out. Who's out there every damn night? And so every time we have contact with the NVA, we were fighting a regular NVA army. up in the highlands there, where near Pleiku, where Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam come together. And I was always there. Every time something happened, I was there. So I didn't last very long. And 68 was not a good time to be there. And I didn't like war. And they couldn't have prepared me for war. And I saw and did things I never dreamed I'd have to see or do. And the day before I was wounded, it's hard for me to share these stories with this, what's going on in Iraq right now. They're just blowing people up over there. And, I'm very sensitive to that. And anybody else in here who has family there, or any servicemen who are veterans, please know that I love you. And that my story, if you'll stick it out, it's got a good ending today. But that day, September 1st, 1968, we went in on a hot LZ and we just went in with weapons and water because we knew we were going to have contact with the NVA. And there weren't very many of us that got on the ground before the enemy opened up on us and the rockets were coming out of the trees, popping, and they hit those helicopters and the helicopters are down. It was a very small LZ and the LZ's blocked and the helicopters are burning. And we can't get any more help in, and there's just a few of us that are stranded on this hot LZ in deep, 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 deep mountain jungle. And we're in big trouble. And the CO radioed that he was going to fly over and drop some firefighting equipment to us and some C4 plastic explosives, and hopefully we could blow down some trees, put out some of the fire, and make room to get some more help in there because we were terribly outgunned. And as he came and hovered over the LZ to drop that firefighting equipment to us, I was watching to see where it would fall because I'm in charge. And as I'm watching that helicopter, here come another rocket out of the trees and just popped that helicopter right in front of me, and it just wobbled and fell into the fire with the others. Me and a kid named Henderson, we jumped up from our spot on the perimeter and we ran into that fire and we started getting guys out of that helicopter, and one of them was so horribly wounded that he became a living nightmare for me. He became somebody who became a part of my everyday for the rest of my life. This young man had both his legs blown off. And his face was destroyed. One of his arms was dangling off. But he was still alive. And we used our bootlaces to put tourniquets on his legs so that he'd stop bleeding. We put pressure all over him to try to slow the bleeding. And we covered his mouth to try to muffle his cries so he wouldn't draw fire without suffocating him. And the medic finally came and took that young kid. And I went back into the fight. I never knew who he was. I never saw him again. I figured he just died. But I lived with nightmares of that kid since September 21st, 1968. And that was a wonderful excuse to get drunk. I've had a lot of good excuses for getting drunk. And "you don't understand" was pretty much a pat answer for me when anybody would try to help me. I've had a lot of wonderful people try to help me because I'm a pretty good old boy, really. You know, I'm not a bad guy. I just do and go and say things I wouldn't normally do and go and say when I'm drinking. And people have tried to help me, but I always felt, "you just don't understand." You see, I grew up in this abusive home where my dad would lock me in the closet and hold my hand over the stove, beat me with belts and straps and lock us in the closets and dangle us over the furnace. And then I'd go off to war, and it was horrible. And the next day in that same LZ, I was shot, and I walked up on an enemy position. I was shot twice. I lost my left hip, and I lost my left ankle. Both rounds went right through joints. And if you've ever heard the expression, "I'm going to blow your ass off," happened to me. I carry my billfold over here, because I ain't got one, see? So it looks like I got something going on over here, see? That's because I want all you little Phyllises and Larrys to know that I'm okay. But I was hurt real bad. And a young kid named Dwayne Grindle, and if anybody knows him, I'm looking for him. I haven't been able to find him in all these years, but a young kid named Dwayne Grindle crawled up under that gun and pulled me down, got me to a dust off, and they sent me to a hospital in Yokota, Japan. I was there 7 weeks, and they sent me to a hospital in California, and then a hospital in Texas, and then I was finally sent to Reynolds Army Hospital in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, so I could be close to my family. When I turned 21, I'd been in the hospital 4 months. When I turned 22, I was still there. I had a gross staph infection that would not heal. I spent the first 9 months of my hospitalization in what they call a spica or a body cast, where I'm in plaster from my chest down. They've got my whole body immobilized. Can't move anything but my arms. And they cut little windows in it, and they would open those windows to treat my wounds. And they'd stuff that gauze way down in those deep holes inside of me, trying to get it to heal from the inside out. But since I didn't have any joints, they just put big pins and screws in there trying to get it to stay together. And it was just the opposite. You know, the infection wouldn't heal while there was something foreign in there, but they couldn't take what was foreign in there because then I wouldn't heal, and I was in a real catch-22. And I suffered terribly. And it was so bad. I mean, when you're in a cast from your chest down, it irritated my nipples. They had to cut my titties off. Where's that harmonica? This is sad. I was angry too. I was pretty angry about being there. I'm in a lot of pain. And in that cast, they can't give you injections or anything anywhere but in your arms. It didn't take long for my arms to become so scarred that they weren't soft enough to accept fluids. And they did crazy, strange things to put things into me. But I can remember them giving me pain medication. And you'd hear that needle go into my shoulder. It sounded like it was going into balsa wood. And I'd just cry because when they'd give me that injection, it would just run right back out around the needle and down my arm because it couldn't go into all that scar tissue. And don't you cry. Don't you be afraid. Don't you feel bad. And I could do that in that situation. You know, they used to bring in the guys, they'd bring guys in and put them in my room so I could cheer them up. I was that big of a clown. I was in that much denial. I had that kind of living skill that I could take reality and push it far, far, far away. And as long as I had enough alcohol and drugs, I could reinforce anything I wanted to believe. Never dreaming that that was going to be a problem for me. See, I got this horrible pain in my hip. When I finally got out of the hospital, I had an open draining wound in my buttocks for 7 years. And I'd wear big gauze bandages over here so it wouldn't run out on my clothes. And I have chronic pain. They got my ankle diffused solid, but they didn't get my hip diffused solid. And it moves just about 5 degrees. And that 5 degrees is just enough to cause me horrible pain. And I live with daily, chronic, severe pain. And you don't understand. You see, these pills I take are prescribed. Most of them. And of course, I never told the doctors what I was mixing with them. So. All I know is it hurts. And I can't bend. All the furniture in my home is custom. Barhythe. Because I can't bend. I have not touched that left foot in 28 years. I can't cut my own toenails. I can't change my own shoe. Because I can't bend. See, I don't have a hip joint. So I sit on my right cheek on bar stools. I got custom toilets. I got custom furniture. If you come to my house to eat, we're going to sit around a Barhythe custom built dining room table. And you know, I can't sit in the back seat of cars. I live with this disability my whole life, and I just thought, you don't understand. This hurts. It's painful. I was a dock worker. That has nothing to do with boats, Gene. I just meant Dr. A didn't know what Dr. B was giving me. Dr. B didn't know what Dr. C was giving me. And, you know, I could walk into any clinic and drop my pants, and they'd go, oh, shoot. What do you need, honey? Yeah. How'd you get that? Oh, yeah. I took lots of pain medication. But you know what? I never thought that I had a problem with pain medication. I had very real pain. And, you know, I can't get to sleep nights. You know, when I try to lay down and go to sleep nights, I see my dad beating my mama. When I try to lay down and go to sleep at night, I see that young kid blown to pieces on that landing zone. When I try to lay down and go to sleep at night, I remember laying in that hospital all those months and months and months and year and months and months. You know, and I'm not very skilled at relationships, and I'm married and divorced and married and divorced. And I don't know about you guys, but when my wife wanted to punish me, one of the things she'd do is she'd withhold her sexual favor. I hate that one. You know, and that just, I don't like going to bed, you know. It's hard to go to bed at night with a pretty girl and you can't touch her. You know, I mean, shoot, I got a sleep disorder. I got a problem with sleep, you know. And who would begrudge me a drink? You know, and yeah, I'm drinking out of bigger and bigger glasses all the time. Never thought I had a problem. 1,000 excuses. All of them true. But I just didn't have any skills to live in the reality of my circumstance and situation. Denial's a bitch. You know, I like delusion better because I think it suits us better. Denial kind of reminds me of Bill Clinton, you know. I did not have sexual relations with that one. Then that's denial, folks. That's just flat out lying, okay? And denial to me always seemed to equate to not telling the truth. But delusion, you see, delusion's my truth. When I'm living in delusion, I'm living in my truth. It just doesn't happen to be real. But when I tell you I don't have a drinking problem, I wasn't lying. That's my truth. Towards the end of my drinking career, I'll tell you how it works. I could always explain why I was drunk. I like the car races. I've been an auto racing, NASCAR racing fan forever. And I was down at Speed Weeks. Yep. I was down there at Speed Weeks in Daytona, Florida. I'm divorced again. By myself again, but I hooked up with some good old boys. You know, they got some good old boys down there, and of course I always hook up with the ones that are carrying the big cooler up in the stands. You know, I never hooked up with the family carrying the little playmates. You know, the big old burly boys carrying that big old two-handled cooler up in the stand. You know, that's the one I'm going to hook up with, so I met these guys. What's that say? I can't see. I met these guys, and we're going to all the races around Speed Weeks. They race all week long there in Florida, and we went to the Tampa State Fairgrounds and all these different racetracks. These guys were race nuts just kind of like me, and they drank like me, so we fit together real good. And one night, we'd been at the Florida State Fair, and we watched the cars go in a circle on the dirt mile and had a good time. Then we left there, and the state fair's going on. So we walked around the fairgrounds and threw balls at Cupid dolls and scoped out the girls and ate corny dogs and you know, just kind of had a good time there at the fair. And then we left, and we went to a nightclub. Now, I'll never forget this nightclub. It's called The Pit. It's cool. And the reason it's called The Pit is because they had a big hole dug in the ground, and you'd go down in that pit and dance. You know, and I love to dance. Now, I might be crippled, but let me tell you, I know when I get it going, all of you girls want me. I know it. I got my fake jewelry hanging over the rail, you know. I'm trolling for little Laurie's and Phyllis's. You know. And I've been drinking 12, 14 hours this day and eating them little pills. I like to wear 501 blue jeans. They got that little pocket right there? That's my pill pocket. You don't even have to carry a bottle or nothing. You just fill that pocket up in the morning when you start. Go along there. Somebody say, what you got there? Oop, tic-tac. Can I have one? Nope. Just ran out. Anyway, I drink beer, but I like to drink bourbon. Okay, I'm a bourbon drinker. A whole lot of bourbon, little bit of Coke. And I drink bourbon, and I'm dancing, and I've been drinking and dancing all day. And I don't know about you guys, but I get sick a lot. And it's hard to be cool and be sick. So I go outside. I'm sick. And in February in Florida, 2 in the morning, it's cold outside. But I am sweating. If there's anybody here that's not sure if you're an alcoholic, now this is not a dead giveaway. But if you've done this, might want to look at it. That stuff just blowing out of my face. I got puke on my pants. It's on my fake alligator boots. It's all over this poor guy's car. Oh! I got little pieces of corn dog stuck up my nose. Oh! Go back in the club. Get myself another drink. I got to get that taste out of my mouth. Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
I'll be telling Lori. Oh, honey, I got sick. Whew. I promise you, I swear, as long as I live, I will never, ever, ever again eat another State Fair corn dog. That greasy damn thing made me sick. Two and two is four. That's up, that's down, and that corn dog made me sick. That's delusion. That's delusion because, you see, I believed myself when I said those things. And when I never quit drinking, the idea of not drinking was the stupidest thing I could have ever come to mind with. Why would I not drink? You don't understand. I live with this horrible pain and disability. And my wife has left me again. And the kids don't mind. And the creditors are on my back. And the VA don't give a damn. And I don't get my fair share. And nobody understands. And I just as soon whoop you as look at you. And you better buy me a drink. Anyway, I've stayed drunk too long, I know. Okay. Never dreamed I had a problem with drinking. Never dreamed. I never took a pill I didn't need. Or I was, you know, I took some that I thought I might need later, okay? I quit being a martyr a long time ago, you know. Just because it doesn't hurt right now does not mean it's not going to hurt. And I don't know why the hell I should wait till it hurts to take that pill, when I can take it now and beat it to the punch, okay? And that made perfect sense to me. Well, I've been in and out of sanitariums. And, you know, I've been to biofeedback therapy and marriage counseling and individual counseling and veterans counseling and post-traumatic stress disorder counseling. And I've been to all these counseling places and, you know, nothing helps. You know, I'd see this doctor and he'd give me Valium, and I'd see this doctor give me Vax or something. And I had a lot of good drugs that I liked, you know. But finally went where I didn't want to go, and that was to a VA counselor. I just figured those guys, you know, they were like, they was apt to lock me up. Every time I got locked up, it was through the VA, so I didn't like going there. But I was pretty desperate, and I'd seen on TV where Valium was addictive and that it was being overprescribed, and a lot of people were having trouble with it, and I was having trouble with Valium. Now, I wouldn't copped anything else, but Valium was giving me a problem, you see, because I'm always out of Valium. I don't know why that is, but I'm constantly out. And, you know, the greatest fear for an alcoholic or an addict is to run out. You know, you just, you know, we didn't have a liquor bar at my home. We had a liquor closet. And because we weren't going to run out. Whew. But I was always running out of Valium. And when I'd run out, I mean, it was just like, oh, I mean, you know, Jesus. Yeah, ooh, you know, and I can't even drink when I'm out of Valium, you know, because when the, you can't, you know, the withdrawals are so bad, you choke on water, you know. I need help. So I went to see this doctor and said, man, I got to get off this Valium, get on Xanax or something, because it's killing me, man. He said, well, you know, Valium's a tough drug to get off. You might want to go to a medical detox. And you know, if it was going to be hard, I didn't want nothing to do with it. So I agreed to a medical detox. And I went into a hospital. And that was on July 1st, 1985. And I haven't had a drink since June 30th, 1985. So. Now, I had no intentions of quitting drinking. You know, my intent was to go in there, get off the Valium, get on something else. And then go on about coping the best I could cope. But what happened was, they was a little sharper than me. Not hard. And they kept me quite a while. And I consider my sobriety date July 11th. Because I took my last little pill down there at the nurse's station on July 10th. And on July 9th, I was pretty well detoxed. And I really didn't need that last Librium tablet from the nurse's station. But it had my name on it. And those of you who've never abused pain medication won't understand when it starts to call your name. Otto. Otto. So I had to go take it. And, you know, I knew I didn't need it. And that's when I knew that I didn't have the power to choose anymore. July 10th, 1985. And so I became a little more willing. And you know what? A lot of my fears were set aside because I didn't die. I just knew I was going to die. I was scared to death when I went to treatment. You know, one thing we hate to do is give up control. You know, because if you're not in control, you can't get your drink when you want it. You know, heaven forbid you put me somewhere where I can't get my drink when I want it. You know, and they put me in this treatment center, and I'm trying to explain to them, you know, that I've got this sleep disorder and all kinds of other ailments, and yes, I understand I need to get off Valium, but you really need to, you know, to help. I need something to help me get to sleep. And the nurse, she says, oh, Otto, honey, you'll sleep when you get tired. Here's another one that don't understand, you know. So I tried to explain it to her from over here. You know how if you just change it a little, maybe they'll understand it this time? Okay. You don't understand. You see, I need something to help me get sick. See, oh, Otto, honey, nobody ever died from a lack of sleep. And I thought, well, you might, you bitch, if I don't get something right now. I was scared. That's pretty slick in there. These people have seen folk like me and you before. And the wonderful thing that happened was once they got me detoxed so I could begin to hear a little bit was people from AA came to that treatment center and told their stories, kind of like I'm telling mine tonight. And it was the first time in my life I ever met people that didn't try to tell me about me. Lots of wonderful people tried to help me my whole life. And they'd always start out with, Otto, you. Otto, you drink too much. Otto, you just need to get a little more sleep. Otto, you just need to save a little more money. And I'd always think, you just need to get out of my face. Because you don't understand. See, I ain't never told anybody the truth, so they can't tell me nothing about me. If my mouth's moving, I'm lying. So how can you know about me? Well, come in the treatment center, you folks come up to tell your stories, and you tell your stories much like I'm telling mine, that's in the first person. And to me, that's what makes Alcoholics Anonymous work. And that's why our singleness of purpose is so important. Because you see, it's one alcoholic telling him about himself. Not trying to tell the alcoholic about himself. Telling that alcoholic about himself. That it gives the alcoholic the opportunity to identify his own alcoholism. And that's exactly what happened to me. Because people came in and they told my secrets. They shared the things that I was afraid to tell anybody about myself. They had corny dogs in their nose and stuff. And they told people about it. Jiminy Christmas. And you all were the damnedest folks I ever saw. Not only had you had a life experience similar to mine, some a little different, some a little different, but the big picture was the same. I mean, there was a black guy, 73 years old, come in to tell his story. I'm 37 when I get sober. What do you mean a black 73-year-old guy have in common? But when he started talking about the way he drank and the things that happened to him, he tried to kill himself through asphyxiation. He turned the gas on in his stove. His life's unmanageable. His best plans don't work, and he just blew the house up. And he's burned all to hell. And his fingers are burned to stubs, and he's black, but he's pink from the burns. And he stood in front of us in that hospital room and told us about his alcoholism and drug addiction. And I could no longer say, but you don't understand. And more amazing was I could see in his eyes that sucker was happy being who and where he was that day, doing what he was doing. And it is the damnedest thing I ever saw. And I couldn't get enough of this guy. I couldn't get enough of all you guys that would come up to the hospital. You know, it's like somebody been telling a joke my whole life and I didn't get it. You ever been in a room where somebody's telling a joke and you don't get it and everybody's laughing and you just kind of, yeah. And then all of a sudden it's, I'll be damned. I'm an alcoholic. Go figure, a stud like me. How could that be? You know what? I think my mom. I think my dad. I think my... Hey, mom, dad, we're all alcoholics. Come on. They were not excited. They did not come to my family week. I don't have a family tree. I have a family thicket, okay? But I was excited. I really was. I was excited, you know. Whoop, it's like I get it. You know, I knew there was something wrong, but I just always thought it was me. You know, I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not fast enough, I'm not quick enough, I'm not slick enough, I'm not cool enough. You know, I just can't get it together. I'm dancing as fast as I can. I'm trying to be the best employee, soldier, son, neighbor, citizen I can be. But it don't work. And I'm always in trouble and I don't know why. And by golly, I got the answer to the why. I'm an alcoholic. You know what? I drink, and when I drink, I do say, go and do, I do things, go places, say things I wish I hadn't said, shouldn't have done, shouldn't have gone. I have consequences as a result of having drank. Step on people's toes and they retaliate seemingly without provocation. Man, and for me it was good news. I was excited. But you know what? I still got the pain. This pain's real. My disability's real. And I still got the same asshole for a dad, okay? And I still got the same brothers, and I still got the same collectors, and I still got the same kids that don't mind, and the same ex-wives that are all mad. You know, and I'm not looking forward to getting out of treatment. Okay? I know that when I don't drink, before I went to treatment, I always kind of used the analogy, if I'm not drinking, my life's like fingernails on a chalkboard. Yeah? So you take away the drinking, what's left? Shoot, this is not a good plan. I'm in a tough spot. I'm an alcoholic. You know, and they won't let me drug either. Oh, no. Shoot, what are we going to do? What are you going to do? What do we do? How'd you do this? I don't know. What do we do? And this guy named Mike, who's a young guy, new in sobriety. If you don't have a lot of sobriety and you think you can't help because you don't have enough sobriety, wrong. Okay? All you have to do is just have a few days more sobriety than the person you're trying to help, okay? And this guy showed up at the hospital, and he don't know come here from Sikkim, but he brought the magic to me, let me tell you. And because, you see, I was disturbed. I had seen this program of recovery that they had on the wall at the treatment center. It's those 12 steps. You know, and it didn't take me long to read down there, you know, made over palace over alcoholism. That was good news. Can't you believe it? Circular stores to Sandy. My nickname is Crazy Otto. Blew right through that. They just said, just turn our will and our lives under the care of God. God damn. It's a God deal. I'm screwed now. I don't believe in God. Now what do we do? Oh, man, I've been duped. You know, I went to treatment at a Catholic hospital. St. Anthony's Hospital. I should have known better. You know, I should have went to Schick or someplace where they're going to help me. You go to a churchy hospital, you get a churchy solution. Oh, man. I want it out. Let me out. Let me go. And they said, well, if you leave, it'll be against medical advice. Well, that means insurance won't pay. That's right. I ain't paying for this. You ever get indignant? I ain't paying for this. So I stayed. Didn't have anywhere else to go. Stayed for all the wrong reasons. And Mike was talking to me. And he says, what's your problem with God? Oh, man, I started telling him, if there's a God, he must be a damn terrorist. You know, if there's a God, where the hell's he been? You know, if there's a God, where was he when my dad was beating my mama? You know, when my dad left for the last time, then my little brother Jack, he beat my mama. And he'd come in and he'd take her TV or stereo or purse, whatever he needed to go buy his drugs. And he'd beat my mama. And then I'd come down there to try to save my mama and call the police and they'd take him to jail. And they served a warrant on him for using stolen credit cards. And they went before the judge and I said, Your Honor, please help my brother. He's a glue sniffer and a paint sniffer. Help him. Put him somewhere where he can get help. Get him away from my mama. I'm sleeping with pistols. Fear my own brother. Help us. Help my mother, please. The judge said, this is unusual. The family usually begs for mercy. I said, no, put him somewhere. Put him somewhere. I got no idea about alcoholism, drug addiction. 2 years state penitentiary in McAllister, Oklahoma, Big Mac, where they put him to work painting. My best thinking sucks. My best plans don't work. This is the unmanageability in my life. This is the unmanageability in my brother's life, you see? They put him to work painting, and guess what? He huffed up and got high. And they put him in a holding cell to transfer him back to maximum security, and he hanged himself. And I felt terrible. I felt that was my fault. And at night when I lay down to go to sleep, I see my brother twisting on that T-shirt, or my dad on my mama's chest, or those men blown to pieces in Vietnam, or I lay in that hospital bed again. And you don't understand. If there's a God, I don't want anything to do with him. The day I was shot, the first thing I thought, I was by myself, lost in the jungle. Rap! Short burst of machine gun fire cut me in two. I fell to the jungle floor. My first thought was, I've been shot. Second thought, God help me. This is the truth. September 22nd, 1968. Third thought. There is no God. September 22nd, 1968, laying underneath an enemy automatic weapon, listening to them talk. They got out of their hole. They came, took my watch off my wrist. They took a knife and cut the straps on my ruck and pulled it off me and went and got back in their hole, not from me to you. And I lay there with that gun pointed at the top of my head, and there was no God. there's a God, I don't want anything to do with him. If there's a God, where was he when Hitler was pulling off the Holocaust? There's just two. Where's God when the hurricanes and the floods and the tornadoes? I'm mad. If it's a God deal, I'm... And Mike, poor little Mike, just a little bit of sobriety. You know, it's like his first time on a Brahma, okay? He says, well, Otto, he says, you quit too soon. He says, in that third step, it's God as we understand him. You don't have to believe in that God you gave up on in Vietnam. What a concept. And with those words, that nearly, just barely sober kid gave me the keys to the kingdom because he let me out of that corner I had myself painted into where there wasn't a God. And he said, what would God have to be? He asked me this question. What would God have to be for you to take a chance and try and turn your will and your life over to his care, not control? You get to keep control, Otto. Just let him care for you. And you don't have to do it, just try. What would he have to be? Now, I thought that was a stupid question. I always thought I was supposed to figure out what I was supposed to be. What do I have to do to get you to like me? What do I have to do to earn my higher power's grace? What do I have to do to get my dad to get off my ass? And this is just 180 opposite. What does God have to be for me to let him care for me? I mean, if Ross Perot were to come walking in here, I'm kind of a Ross fan. You know, if Ross were to come in and go, Otto, I care about you. Hey, I'm getting excited because Ross has got some jack. He can make things happen, okay? I'm in like that, okay? Ross, I'm on board. But what would God have to be? And so I did some writing and just I came up with a real simple God concept. And that is, if God is all powerful and with all his power, all he wants is for me to stay clean and sober. Here's the hook. And like it. If he's all powerful and with all his power, all he wants is for me to stay clean and sober and like it, then I'd be willing to try, not saying that I can do it, I'll try and turn my will and my life over to his care. I keep control. I fully expected Mike to go, no. You misunderstood. No Disneyland gods. Come on, pick a team. What are you going to be? Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist, Christian. Come on, pick a team. You want to get your ponytail and go ching at the airport? What are we going to do? Come on. But that's not what he said. He says, that's your God. You pray to that God. You pray to a God that has all the power and wants you to stay clean and sober and like it. Now, I did not believe for a minute that it would work. Not one minute. But I am pretty sharp, and I know that if I document my efforts to do those things that you suggest, go to a meeting every day, get a sponsor, read the literature, make a phone call, ask God for help, then I'll get sober and like it. So I documented all my efforts. Because when I get drunk, I'm suing AA. I kept this beautiful logbook of my meetings, my calls to my sponsor. I'd had guys come to my house, we'd read the book out loud because I want witnesses. Okay? I want them to come testify at this hearing because I am going to own all of this, okay? I might get drunk, but I'm going to be a rich drunk, okay? People say that motives matter. I'm not real big on that. You know, if you go to college and you get a degree because mom and daddy wanted you to, you still get the degree. Motives just make the difference on whether or not you enjoy it while you're doing it. You know, but if you do the right thing, you get the right result. And I did all the right things for the wrong reasons. I mean, they'd say things like, Otto, if you want what we got, just keep coming back. Boy, there's some cute little girls at that club I was going to. And I thought, man, I'd like to have some of that. Okay, I'll be right back. And so I come for all the wrong reasons. But what happened was, is you guys loved me when I was unlovable. You guys showed me a way of life that I had no clue existed. You guys brought me into a world that I had never experienced before. And it wasn't just a question of teaching me. It wasn't just a question of me reading or praying or doing anything else. You guys showed me on a daily basis how to live life on life's terms. I watched you guys. It's the best dollar show, $2 show in town. I watched you have babies and lose them. I watched you get cancer and die. I watched you... do that. I watched you go through marriage and divorce. I watched you do all the things that I thought were impossible. You convince me. How do you do that? Well, Otto, back to the steps. Oh, it's that God guy again. Okay. You know, I don't even know how to pray when I got here. Prayer, how do you pray? I don't know how you pray. I was afraid to pray. I don't know. I'm scared if there's a God. If there's God, I don't know. How do you pray? How do you pray? I don't know how to pray. I ain't going to ask nobody how to pray. So I used to wait till I went to bed at night. Then I'm going to pray. I don't want anybody to see. I ain't about to get on my knees. And I was sharing a room with a couple other guys. I didn't want them to see me pray. You know, but I used to masturbate every night. Matter of fact, sometimes a couple times a day, okay? And I'm in bed this night, and I have decided to pray. And I don't know how to do it, and I got this dilemma. Masturbate and pray, or pray and masturbate. I don't want to do it wrong. I mean, I really want it to work. I'm scared to death that if I would relieve myself first, then he's going to be mad, and then he's not going to listen to my prayer. But if I pray first, and he's real, he might not let me. You know. What'd you do? That's a true story, and I don't share it with you to be vulgar, and it is a pretty good laugh, but the fact of the matter is the point I want to make is you can't do it wrong. If you ask God for help, you can't do it wrong. You know, I have come to know and believe with all my heart that all you have to do is just want just a little bit and ask for God to come into your life, and He'll rush in any little crevice, any little crick in the door, any little opportunity we give Him. He's dying to get in. And as soon as I said, God, help me. My first prayer went like this. God, help me. I wonder what Pat's doing. I'll bet there's somebody with her right now. I bet there's a pickup truck in her driveway right now. I'm going to kill that bitch. That's my first prayer. That's about it. I mean, my brain was just like a balloon you let go of, you know. But it was good enough. It was good enough. You know, and so I set about to work these steps, best of my ability. You know, and my spa had a great sponsor. I was blessed. You know, they say get is a good sponsor. I don't know how you know a good one when you get here. How do you know a good one when you get here? I don't know. I got lucky. I got a good one. And I forgot where I was. Oh, okay. Anyway. He encouraged me to work these steps. And he told me the purpose of working the steps, isn't that gross? Have you ever seen a speaker do that before? I don't know. I'm just winging it, folks, okay? He says, Otto, you don't work the 12 steps to get sober. He says, you get sober by not drinking. I have yet to get drunk on a day I didn't drink. This guy is brilliant. I mean, he's got it. He says, we work the 12 steps to have a spiritual awakening. That's why we work the steps. The steps are just suggested. You don't have to work the steps to get sober. Just quit drinking. But if you want to enjoy your sobriety, you might want to consider having a spiritual awakening, which is the product of working the 12 steps. It doesn't say having had a spiritual awakening as a result, one of many. It is the result. It is the desired result of working the steps, a spiritual awakening. That means that I come to know and have a new relationship with God, with my higher power. It doesn't matter whether I was religious when I got here or not. I'm going to improve upon my relationship with God by working these 12 steps, and that's exactly what happened to me. I did a four-step inventory, and I told my sponsor when I did it. I said, I will not go back to Vietnam, and I will not go back to my childhood. I thought that'd pretty much get me out of doing one, you know. I thought he'd say, well, when you're ready to do it all, you let me know. That's not what he said. He said, well, we'll do the rest then. Won't you get a pencil and paper and write down everybody that ever pissed you off? I could do that. Okay? And yeah, I did that inventory and I found out that my problems were of my own making. I'd been a victim my whole life. I had a victim mentality my whole life. I always felt like I was a good guy that was just on the short end of the stick. I never had a clue that my problems were of my own making. I never had a clue that I was afraid of anything. I'd have told you at age 37, walking out of that treatment center, I'm not scared of nothing. I'll whoop you. I ain't never lost a fight. And I believed that with all my heart. And it wasn't until I did an inventory I found out I'm afraid of everything. I'm afraid of the dark. I'm afraid of going broke. I'm afraid you won't laugh when I'm trying to be funny. I'm afraid you'll laugh when I'm not trying to be funny. I'm afraid I'm going to be by myself. I'm afraid I'm going to have pain and not having medication. I'm afraid. You know, and I found out that I'm selfish and self-centered, and I have this bias and prejudice of self, and that I see things through a bias and a prejudice, and things aren't always the way I see them. Hell, I used to think if I saw it, felt it, that's kind of the way it was. You know, that I'm kind of like the standard unit of measure, and that everything else is, you know, off plumb. And, you know, I'm just selfish. And so I didn't know that my perspective was a perspective, one of many. You know, that you may not be seeing the same thing I'm seeing, even though we're standing looking out the same window. I didn't know that. You know, I'd come up here, I was so self-centered, I think you guys all talk funny. That's selfish, self-centered. You know, I'm the one talking funny up here. Shoot. But I learned the things my father should have taught me doing that four-step. Things he couldn't teach me. The things he didn't know. I learned basic living skill 101. Doing my four-step. And then I went and did a fifth-step and found out that you guys aren't as mean and ugly as nasty as I am. Because I was scared to death y'all were going to claw my eyes out and beat me up when I told you the truth about me. But you didn't. You know, and I found out that society is really filled with a lot of people that care about each other and want for one another to be happy. And that are glad to see me getting better. Wow, my whole psyche changed. My whole attitude towards other people changed. Today I live in the promises. I live in a world that I didn't know existed. I truly live in the promises. Everything's been made right for me. There's a long version to our serenity prayer. It says that God will make everything right if we'll just completely give ourselves to Him. And I have to say that I've been in the middle of the wagon for a long time. It's one thing to get on the wagon. But if you're going to get on the wagon and you want to stay sober, get in the middle. Okay? Get in the middle of the wagon. It's hard to fall off the middle of the wagon. Okay? I got in the middle. And I've been sober and liking it for a long time. And I found out what needed changing in my life. If the lines at the grocery store had to get shorter for me to get happy, I'm screwed. Because I always pick the long, slow line. My clerk, my checker is always an idiot. You know? The machine always breaks down but just before I'm getting there, you know. And if that has to stop happening for me to be happy, I'm screwed. You know what? But if I can become a little more tolerant, patient, and understanding, then those events don't bother me. And when I did my inventory, I found out all the things about me that were causing me so much pain and suffering. If my mom, dad, ex-wives, and kids had to change for me to get happy, I'd be screwed. Because they have not. My father died a few years ago, and I buried a loved one, not a lovable one. He never became lovable. He was barred from every tavern in Oklahoma City and had to go out in the country to drink. He was such an ass. But I'd stop on my way home from the meeting at the prison at that little tavern and sit with my dad and have a Coke and scratch his old burr head and let him know I loved him. Even though he'd say ugly things to me. And I knew the joy of loving my father for years before he died. And I learned how to do that in here. Because you see, when I started... when I started trying to help the newcomer, you weren't particularly lovable. And I found out that, you know, just because if I... for the first time in my life, reached out and tried to help or do for somebody, expecting nothing in return, knowing that there was nothing for me, what happened was I fell in love with you. I always thought you had to do something to make me love you. I had it Bass Ackards. You know what? All I have to do is choose to love you. And if you let me, then I'll fall in love with you. The warm fuzzy comes after my action, not after yours. So, life started getting better for me. I'm making my amends. I'm cleaning house. I'm doing the things that are suggested. And while I'm doing that, God's doing that for me, all the things I couldn't do for myself. My first wife came to me when I was about 3 years sober. She says, "You're doing so good. You take the little bitch before I kill her." My daughter come to live with me. She's a little bitch. She comes by it honestly now. Let me tell you, she's got parents. She got parents, okay? And I told her, I said, "Holly, I don't know how this is going to work out, sweetheart." I said, "I'm just going to love you no matter what. I'm going to love you the way God loves us all. I'm going to love you the way we love each other in AA. Just because I want to be your loving father." She was not impressed. She set about to make my life a living hell. What a little bitch. I wanted to reach over and pull the lips off of her face on more than one occasion. How did you learn to talk like that? Jesus Christmas. But you know what? I made good on my promise. With your help and with the help of my higher power, and thanks to Al-Anon, of which I've been a member for 18 years. An active member. If you find that you've been sober a while and you're not liking it, I invite you to come on over to Al-Anon and sit in 6 meetings. You might just figure out that defective relationships are the cause of most all our problems, including our alcoholism. And that as we improve our relationships, our sobriety improves. And that's what happened to me. I got sober in AA. I got happy in Al-Anon. Anyway, I made good on my promise. And you know what? Instead of calling her names and pointing out all of her shortcomings, I just closed the room door and let it be dirty. And I just, you know, when the room and the dishes started to stink and she got tired of it stinking, she took them into the kitchen. And when she got tired of wearing dirty clothes, she cleaned them up. And you know what? After a while, we started to tighten up a little bit. We started to get along when I just was her loving father instead of this lord and master, you know, dictator of punishment and how things should be. Things started getting better. She'd been with me about 3 years, and we're doing great. And I bought her a little car. Now, I'm a car guy. She can't drive. So she ain't going to drive my car because I got a cool car, okay? But I bought her this little 82 Prelude. I mean, it was so cute. But she couldn't, no way she could get hurt in it. You know, you step on the gas, it just makes more noise and the tack goes up, but nothing else happens, you know? No way she can get hurt in that up there. Because she's a curb banger. She wears glasses. She can't drive. Anyway, we're doing great. She comes to me one night. It was a beautiful night, and we've been getting along so good. She says, "Dad, can I take your car? Just tonight. It's a beautiful night." I had a convertible. "Can Kristen and I put the top down and take your car tonight?" Oh, okay. Be careful. Away they went. You know what happened. Wasn't 30 minutes. Ring! "Dad, I was going too fast and I crashed the car." "You okay?" "Is Kristen okay? Can you drive the car?" "Where yet?" "Where they're not supposed to be. Stay right there at that phone. I'll be right there." I hung up the phone. I was so mad. I could kill that little... God. All bets are off. I don't care what I promised. Anything but my car. I have put up with some crap in the 3 years she's been with me. But not my car. Okay? And I'm in that little Prelude going to get her. It's making lots of noise, but it ain't getting me there. And I'm about to pull that wheel off the column because I know I'm going to be driving it for a while, you know? And I'm playing that conversation over and over in my head, you know, where she says and then I say and then she says and I say. And when she says, I'm going to say and then this is going to be good. And I heard her say, Dad, I was going too fast and I crashed the car. I heard what she said. She did the unthinkable. She did the unheard of. She copped to it. She didn't make up a story. I told my dad, Dad, a deer ran out in front of me and I swerved to miss it, I swear. And my dad beat the hell out of me. Don't you know what that car means to this family? Didn't I tell you to be careful? And that night I was able to go to Holly and comfort her. She knows what that car meant to me. She knows what it's going to do to insurance. I don't have to tell her. She's dying. She's dying inside. Isn't that a great time for Dad to come whip your ass when you're just dying? But through God's grace, I was able to go and comfort her that night, knowing that she's dying. And we grow closer. And today I have the family that I always dreamed to have. I'm grandpa today. You know? When I leave here, I'm going to Boston to hang out for 6 days with a whole bunch of 11-year-olds going to Boston and New York City. I have not yet been restored to full sanity, okay? But I'm a pretty damn good grandpa, let me tell you. And I like me today. That's something I never did before, was like me. I like me a lot today. And I like AA, and I like what's happened to me. I'm going to tell, I know I've been too long, but I got to tell these last two stories. There ain't nothing that God can't make right. Everything's been made right for me. I'm at the car races on a Friday night like I always go. I go to the races every Friday night. I'm a race nut. That's on my license plate on my car. Race nut. I'll drive hundreds of miles to go to a car race with a forecast of rain. Just hoping maybe they'll run a lap, you know. Maybe I'll get to see them warm up. Okay, I'm a race fanatic. And this night I'm out at the car races in Oklahoma City at Fairground Speedway like I always am. It's a beautiful night. The car count's good. The track's good. There ain't no reason not to be having a good time. And something made me get up and go home. And I don't know what, and I don't know why. But I got up and I left the grandstands and I was leaving. I had this terrible sadness because racing's my passion. And it's gone. And I'm going home. And I don't know why. And I walked into my house and I said, and my wife looked at me like, what are you doing here? What are you? Are you sick? What's wrong? I said, I don't know. I said, I think I just as soon watch TV tonight. 9 o'clock on Friday night, turned on the TV, ABC. I don't know if some of you are familiar with this show. It's called 2020. It was just coming on, and they do three little vignettes. And the first little vignette that come on showed a helicopter flying over the jungles of Vietnam. The name of the story is called The Gift of Life. And it's about a gentleman who's writing a book on emergency room trauma, and he's interviewing the top trauma specialists in the nation. And he's talking to a Dr. Kenneth Swan. And he asked Dr. Swan, what was your worst emergency room trauma case ever? And Dr. Swan began to recount when he was a young surgeon at the 71st Medevac in Pleiku, Vietnam on September 21st, 1968. And they brought in a young soldier who was so gravely wounded that the consensus was to medicate him, set him aside, declare him expectant, and let him die. Both of his legs were blown off. Both of his eyes were gone. He had shrapnel the size of your thumb in the middle of his brain. They had to do a craniotomy and take off the top. His eyes were gone. He had shrapnel the size of your thumb in the middle of his brain. They had to do a craniotomy and take off the top of his head to get the shrapnel out of his brain. His left arm was just barely hanging on. They reattached it backwards. He has no legs. He has no eyes. He's brain damaged. One arm goes behind him, the other in front, and he can feel with two fingers. Good call, Doc. The guy wanted to know, how'd this guy turn out? I mean, he's pretty badly screwed up. I mean, did you save him for a life that means something, or did you save him for a life of horror? And Dr. Swan didn't know, and they set about to find him. It took him 2 years. And they start telling his story. Ken's in a helicopter trying to drop firefighting equipment to infantrymen pinned down in a burning jungle. And a rocket comes out of the trees, blows him out of the sky. And I sat on that sofa and I shook. And my wife came over and she clung to me and she said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "This is my kid. This is my nightmare. This is my story. I know it is." And it was. Ken's married since Vietnam. This guy has no legs. He's not cut off at the knees. He sits on his tailbone. No legs. He's not partially sighted. There are no eyeballs in his head. His left arm goes behind him and his right arm goes in front, and he sits in a wheelchair. And he can barely feel with those two fingers now because he's burned them so many times trying to light cigarettes. But he's married and he's got two kids and he sails and he scuba dives. And they showed a picture of him holding his babies. And I thought, oh my God. And but Ken, he suffers. He struggles. He suffers with post-traumatic stress. He self-mutilates. He can't get enough pain medication. He abuses his family. He sets himself on fire. He shoots himself. He does crazy things to get pain medication, and he can't seem to get home from Vietnam. And he doesn't know what happened to him that day. And I was looking right at him. So I reached out. I reached out to Kenny, and he didn't believe that I was who I said, but I was decorated that day by the commander of his helicopter, and when I was able to provide that name for him, he knew that it was I and a kid named Henderson that got to him that day, and that started Kenny and I on a long-distance relationship, and I was trying to drag Kenny home. Kenny took me where I said I wouldn't go on that four-step. It was time. Kenny took me back to Vietnam, and I relived all that stuff. And I got better. And Kenny got better. Kenny got sober. But like anybody doing hard work, I copped a resentment. They're making a movie about this guy's life. Nobody's called me. It's all about him and Dr. Swan. And hell, I got the cool story, you know. Anyway, stuff. Kenny asked me to send him a letter or some memorabilia from Vietnam for his movie. I put a cover letter with it. On the cover letter, I wrote, "Kenny, I got a resentment." And where I'd stuffed it was, "You know what? You've never told me thank you for saving your life. You know, every time I talk to you on the phone, I'm waiting. Otto, thank you for saving my life." It was no small damn feat. Okay? Where's my thank you? I don't think I'm asking for too much. I'm angry about being drugged back into Vietnam, and that's where I put my anger. We just had to put it somewhere. My wife, I show the letter to my wife. She says, "What is this? You've never said thank you. That doesn't belong in there." I said, "Oh, yes, it does. It's the truth, and I live in the truth." She says, "Isn't there some kind of a spiritual axiom or something that you guys live by or something, you know, where you got a bug up your ass, it's your bug or something like that? Isn't there something about that?" I went back to my word processor. I got to get that line out of there. I don't want to rewrite the whole letter. I just want to rewrite that part, you know. And what came out was God's gift to me. You know, it wasn't about the pictures of Kenny's babies on his chest replacing the horrible images from Vietnam. It wasn't about any of that. What it was about was Kenny, I never said thank you for your sacrifice. Selfish, self-centered. That's the root of my problem. For all those years, I only saw me running out in that fire to get Kenny. Truth is, I'm pinned down in the jungle. Kenny flies into harm's way trying to help me. When that rocket hit that helicopter, he gave his sight. He gave his legs. He entered into that darkness and that disability for me. I'd never seen that. And in a moment, everything changed. You think you can't change the past? I beg to differ. All we have to do is get in touch with the truth. Get in harmony with reality. Free ourselves from self. And we can know the joy that comes from living this life. And it gets better. They told me if I could ever go 10 years without infection, I'd be a candidate for a prosthetic hip, an artificial hip. But I couldn't go 2 years without infection. I'm always in the hospital. I've always got pus running out of me. 10 years sober, guess what? 10 years no infection. When I went to hell and back to get this hip, it didn't come easy. I lost it once to infection. All my worst fears came true. In 10, 11, and 12 years sober. But because of the love of God and the support of this group, you guys brought meetings to my bedside and to my home. And today, I can sit in a chair. And I can put my elbows on my knees. And I can cross my feet and turn my foot. And I live pain-free. For the first time in my adult life, I can sit on a conventional toilet, and I got a pretty good idea I'm going to hit the hoe today. I can sit in the back seat of a car. I just bought a little car on eBay this week. Got a standard transmission. Your heart's desire, that's what they promised me. Said, Otto, you have no idea the joy of living that waits for you if you'll just stop drinking. Come to meetings, hang out, work these steps, try to have a relationship with God and be of service. And today I've been rocketed into a place that I didn't know existed. I'm happier, healthier, more whole physically, emotionally, socially, legally, financially, maritally, parentally than I've ever been in my life. And I thank you for that.